a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And we're available via podcast, either through iTunes, where you can scroll down to the public radio, go to your public radio page and scroll down to KUCI, or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view prior guests, upcoming interviews, and access archives to our past shows. They're up there now and available to you 24 hours a day for free. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, we bring you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books out into the world and into our lives. And this morning, I'm fortunate enough to be joined by for the entire hour by Geraldine Brooks. Geraldine is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of March and Year of Wonders, and the nonfiction works Nine Parts of Desire and Foreign Correspondence. Previously, Geraldine was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Bosnia, Somalia, and the Middle East. Born and raised in Australia, she lives in on Martha's Vineyard with her husband, author and journalist Tony Horwitz, her son Nathaniel, and three dogs. It is her latest novel, People of the Book, available now and published by Viking, that we will focus much of our time on this morning. Geraldine, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
It's great to have you here. You know, because we have the benefit of time this morning and because your own life experiences are just as rich and gripping as your fiction, I'd like to begin there. I'd like to begin with your beginnings. From what I understand, you were an incredibly shy and rather sheltered child, which seems, you know, kind of like an unlikely beginning for a stunning career in journalism, dangerous journalism. Can you talk for a moment about growing up in Australia and that kind of initial path that inspired you to pursue journalism?
I was sick a lot when I was a kid, and I spent a lot of time at home. Luckily, my mother was incredibly imaginative and fun to hang out with, and I guess what it amounted to was I was about half the time homeschooled by her, and I followed a lot of her interests and passions. She would make me a bet on how long it would take me to learn a passage from Shakespeare and things like this. So I wasn't actually wasting my time at home. But it did make me rather wary of the world for quite a long time, and I was really very much in my own world of imagination. But I think looking back on it, that was the genesis of the storyteller in me, because I would entertain myself in these elaborate childish fictions that I would make up.
And it sounds like, you know, in this protective environment, I've read later on she was very kind of open and accepting of, you know, of the dangerous assignments you took. So I was interested in this, you know, this very ultra-protected childhood that then kind of translated into a very liberal license to live as an adult.
She was, I mean, you could have knocked me down with a feather. It wasn't what I would have predicted at all. This was a mother who was always, don't go out without your cardigan on, and you'll catch a cold. And I was very, as the Victorians would say, strictly kept as an adolescent. I didn't go on my first date till I was about 16 years old, and then, you know, with very serious consequences for not getting home on time and all that. So, and yet when I became an adult, it was as if she just was the wind beneath my wings. Anything I wanted to do was fine with her, and I would call her up later on when I was working as a foreign correspondent and say, you know, I'm going into Eritrea in the middle of a civil war. And she said, how fascinating, darling. Have a good time.
Great.
So I was astonished. But that's the kind of mother she was. She wanted you to make sure she got you out the door in one piece when you were vulnerable. And then after that, your life was yours to do what you want.
Do you think you'll follow those same tenets in raising your son?
You know, the world is so different now. I delayed having a family till I was 40 years old, and the result is that my son's world is so different from my world that I think I'm just going to have to be flexible.
Yeah. But that is the truth. Yeah, the way we were raised is so vastly different. It's amazing.
Yeah, I try and give him an old-fashioned childhood as much as it's possible today, and where we live is a great aid and abettor to that, because he still has a lot of the freedoms that I had as a child. Where we live, the kids still go everywhere on their bikes without a lot of parental wing. So it's a kind of a throwback to an earlier, simpler time.
Yeah, that's a luxury today. You wrote an interesting article about feeling very disconnected from your Australian roots as a child because of the void that existed in an Australian literature. And,
well, it didn't really exist, but it was a time when Australians were still suffering from what was called the cultural cringe. At that time, most of the immigrants to Australia it was a kind of a monocultural scene. Everybody had ancestors who were either English or Irish, or, you know, the oddest thing might be another Northern European. But it was very white and very Anglo-Saxon. And as a result, there was a tendency to discredit what was indigenous and to look for your cultural leads back to Britain. And so I felt like my imagination was very much a colonized place as a child, because we read British children's fiction. And a lot of it made absolutely no sense in an Australian context, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never seen frost. The trees didn't lose their leaves in Sydney. And so, you know, your mind is inhabiting this cold Anglo-Saxon place, and your body is in this warm Pacific one. And there was this sort of disjunction there. And there were great writers writing, but we didn't tend to value them in those days. It all changed, of course, but that was how it was back in the early 60s.
Interesting. Yeah, it was so kind of, you know, ironic and tragic to me to think of you knowing the rest of the world so well and yet feeling kind of isolated from the place where you called home, you know, kind of a haunting image.
I know, and I look back on it now and I think of all the, you know, years I spent swatting French when I could have been learning an Aboriginal language that would have put me right in touch with the land in, you know, I mean, when you learn an Aboriginal language, you gain a whole other way of viewing what's around you, and yet that wasn't possible or even thought of when I was coming up.
And that's changed since, you think?
Yeah.
Interesting. So turning to kind of the lessons of journalism and how they may have later applied to your fiction, were there patterns that emerged over the course of your journalism career in either the ways human beings behave or governments behave that kind of bring a sort of inevitability to your way of thinking, or how did that kind of frame your thoughts, that experience?
Well, I had a career that I hadn't expected to have in journalism. It was kind of one of these cases where way leads on to way. I hadn't set out to be a foreign correspondent at all. And when I found I was one, my beat was the Middle East initially. And that meant that I quickly became a correspondent of conflict. So I was thrown into situations where you see people coping with catastrophe. And I guess what really animated me then and continues to in fiction is the question, what does catastrophe do to people? Do you turn to your worst self or your best self?
Mm-hmm.
And as a journalist, I saw examples of both. I saw acts of incredible kindness as well as atrocious brutality, bravery, cowardice. You know, I mean, the whole whipsaw of human experience, really.
What was the situation there when you arrived?
When I arrived, well, I arrived in Cairo on a hot autumn night in 1987, and before I could unpack my bag, the first intifada erupted in Gaza, and so I had to quickly get up to speed on the Arab-Israeli conflict, and then I was in the middle of covering that when the sort of tanker war broke out in the Persian Gulf, and so then I had to get, you know, a handle on Gulf Arab culture and the traditional animosities and alliances that had fluctuated between Persians and Arabs in that region. So it was like being on an unbelievably steep learning curve for the first couple of years.
Wow. And kind of what you've talked about, once you demonstrate an ability to deal with chaotic situations, you're instantly a desirable war correspondent that everybody wants you.
I know. It's like once you know how to be a plumber, nobody ever wants you to do anything else. You know?
Right, right.
even after I'd been doing it for many years and was starting to think, gee, you know, why can't I ever get an assignment sitting around a swimming pool with a celebrity? you know, the things that people think of for you to do always involve heading into a place that everybody else is heading out of.
Heading out of, right, right. So what did you draw upon to deal with those situations? What traits kind of allowed you to survive that environment?
I guess the dirty little secret of foreign correspondence, or that kind of correspondence anyway, is it's the easiest reporting in some ways to do. Because the hard thing is getting there. If you can get yourself to where you need to be, the story is just falling at your feet. You don't have to have a great big fat Rolodex full of brilliant contacts in the Elysee Palace or any of that stuff, because human stories of the most powerful kind are just everywhere around you. So it's really all about logistics. If you can talk your way onto the one aid flight that's going in there, if you can put up with, you know, quite a bit of chaos and discomfort, and then you can do that work.
Do you find that your journalism background, in addition to giving you, you know, images and details, also gives you a sort of emotional intelligence or a psychological insight into human behavior and the ways in which people act under certain stresses that then play out in your fiction?
Well, I think it certainly makes me interested in those questions. And then when I'm thinking about them fictionally, I can draw, for better and for worse, on the things that I know and witnessed at that time. The first battlefield that I ever saw was in southern Iraq, and the Iraqis had just won a few meters of sandy desert from the Iranians, and they were celebrating this victory. And the aftermath was so incredibly horrible, because what it had been a human wave attack, and Iranian teenagers had just been hurling themselves into Iraqi artillery. And basically, it was Gettysburg. You know, it was exactly the same kind of warfare as Pickett's Charge, really. And so when I, you know, years later sat down to try and visualize the Civil War battlefield aftermath, I was able to draw on those horrible images that I hadn't, you know, deliberately hadn't thought about and had pushed down out of mind for such a long time.
Yeah, it's amazing what you would have to accommodate in your head after something like that. You know, it's I would imagine you go through something similar to post traumatic stress?
After the first Gulf War, I was in Kurdistan, and the Kurdish uprising, I think those 2 weeks were some of the best and worst experiences of journalism that I had, and it all turned very dangerous very quickly when Bush the First allowed Saddam to use his helicopter gunships, and he immediately sent them north to crush the Kurds. And I was stuck with a bunch of journalists and a whole, you know, millions of Kurdish civilians just trying to find a way out because they were firing on columns of retreating civilians. And I ended up in the mountains of Turkey. And, you know, when I finally got home after that, I'd seen so many horrible things, and it had just been such a grueling time that I did really feel quite rattled for a while. But the only way out of that for me is to write about it. And so once I'd put it all down on paper, it was like it wasn't in my head so much anymore.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you feel like you have another nonfiction or memoirish sort of piece in you. I know you've written once about your experience over there, but...
I don't think I'm going to revisit that time in my life. I feel like I'm too far removed from it now. I wrote what I thought was the most useful things that I'd learned in a book called Nine Parts of Desire, because there are plenty of people who can write about war and all that, but the opportunities that I had in my 6 years covering that part of the world were to spend a lot of time with women and to watch the different ways they negotiated their lives. So I think I distilled those years of my experience into the best thing that I had to contribute, which was a sort of a portrait of the lives of the women that I got to know, everybody from Palestinian women who were living in polygamous marriages in refugee camps under the stresses of occupation, to Queen Noor, who was trying to transact her difficult role as a Western woman transplanted into an Arab society, but in a position of really great influence.
Amazing. And I want to talk about the role of women also in your latest book. I thought there was some interesting gender explorations that I wanted to get into too, but I'll save that for a moment. And I'm curious about the move into fiction and what fiction accomplishes for you that nonfiction wasn't able to do.
Well, the first thing it accomplished for me was that it allowed me to stay at home with my infant son. and that, I have to be honest and say that the birth of my son was really the thing that pushed me to take the jump off the cliff from the known world of fact and to see if I, you know, could write anything as a novelist. And had he not come along, I'd probably still be a journalist and a nonfiction writer today. But once he was born, I wanted to give him the same kind of childhood that I'd had, which was, you know, having an attentive mother around, and that wasn't compatible with going off on long, open-ended assignments to dangerous places. So I needed a new gig. but then, once I started, I just found that I really love the freedom, because as a journalist, you follow the line of fact, and the line of fact is as far as you can go.
Mm-hmm.
And when you reach the end of the known world, you have to stop. But the novelist is much more kind of Christopher Columbus. You can sail off the edge of the world, and you can enter the void and set your imagination to work there. And I try and do it by using an emotional empathy and animated by the core belief that the human heart doesn't really change that much.
Mm.
And that if you know an emotional truth and how you would feel, you can probably transpose that. And a lot of people disagree with that, and they say you can't know the heart and mind of people, you know, from the past because they're so different from us. And Henry James actually said, you know, they half of the things that make our world were non-existent to them. But I don't think the furniture matters, actually. I think that everybody is animated by the desire to live and to see their children live, by love and by hate and lust and all those things. And I don't think they've changed in a millennia.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was just talking with someone about the difference that separates humans from animals is our ability to imagine a future and to imagine a past and to hopefully learn from that. But I don't, you know, I know that we can imagine it. I don't know if we learn from it.
Yeah. I don't know either. That's a very good question.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, let's delve into the novel because there's so much rich ground to cover. So talk about People of the book and the basic premise and perhaps where the idea originated for you.
So I like to write stories where you can know something but you can't know everything, where there's enough of a factual record to give you a scaffolding and there's an intriguing issue or mystery or problem. So all of my books have that in common. So you take the factual lines as far as they go, and then when you run out of that rope, you have to jump. And in the case of People of the Book, the inspiration is an actually existing Hebrew manuscript that was created in Spain in 1350 or thereabouts. And the book is a remarkable survivor. It still exists today by virtue of a number of rescues, some of which we know about and some of which we can only speculate about. But it survived, for instance, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain when many, many Hebrew books were destroyed. It was in Venice in 1609 when it was saved by a censor, a Catholic priest who was working for the Pope's Office of the Inquisition in Venice. It made its way across the Adriatic and was saved from the Nazis during World War II by a Muslim librarian. And in Sarajevo in the 90s, during the shelling of that city, a Muslim librarian once again risked his life to save it. So that's the factual scaffolding. And I became intrigued by trying to think about all the hands that had held this book and protected it and created it. And we don't know who the creators were. We don't know why, for example, this particular little book is full of beautiful illuminations at a time when Hebrew books typically didn't have any figurative art in them whatsoever because of the commandment against making graven images. So it's a great rarity, and we can only speculate about why it is the way it is and how it survived. So there were a lot of voids for imagination to work on there. And I decided to tie it all together using a character of the near present, a book conservator who's called in to work on the manuscript after the war in Sarajevo. And she finds little artifacts trapped in the binding, a scrap of insect wing and a white hair and a scraping of salt and some wine stains. And as she uses modern science to investigate these things, we, the reader, are transported back in time and we find out how that little thing came to be in the binding of the book.
Just wonderful. How did you yourself become initially aware of the book?
I was actually in Sarajevo. After I stopped covering the Middle East, my beat was the UN, and it was the UN at a time when the peacekeeping operations were involved in conflicts from Somalia to the Balkans. So I was in Sarajevo writing about the UN operations in the city. And the book was missing at that time, and there was a lot of speculation about whether it had been destroyed or whether the Muslim government had sold it to buy arms or whether Mossad had come and taken it to Israel, and nobody knew. It wasn't until after the war that we found out that a librarian named Enver Imamovich had risked his life and gone in and cracked the safe and brought it out of the museum to save it from the shelling.
That's amazing. I should also mention that there's a wonderful article on your website that you wrote for The New Yorker on this topic and, you know, the factual origins of it. If people want to look at that, go to your website, geraldinebrooks.com. It's interesting.
Yeah, that was while I was trying to find out what had happened to the Haggadah during World War II when the Islamic scholar Dervish Korkut saved it. Much to my astonishment, I learned that his widow was still alive because she had been much younger than he when they were married. And I was able to go and talk to her, and I found out what had happened with the Haggadah, but I also learned another incredible story about her husband and his acts of resistance against the Nazis and how he had saved a young Jewish woman, and then how a generation later that debt was repaid in a most unexpected way to a member of his own family. So that story was so great, I didn't want to touch it fictionally, so I wrote it for The New Yorker, and it's called The Book of Exodus, and as you say, it's on my website.
Amazing. Do you have any thoughts after you've spent some years thinking about this, what it was about this particular book, when so many books were being destroyed, what it was about this book that enabled it to exist?
You know, I've thought about it, but I don't think there's any one answer. I mean, it really is beautiful. I mean, you see this book. Well, it has a horrible, tacky binding on it. It was rebound very clumsily in the 1890s, and that binding's all scuffed and discolored. And so it's a small book. I mean, it's no bigger than a normal sort of present-day hardback. And if you saw it in a used bookstore, you probably wouldn't look twice at it. But once you open it, boom, you know, the colors and the artistry of the illuminations just knock your socks off. So I think that it probably, and when I'm thinking back to, you know, the 14th and 15th century, when people's minds weren't besieged by bright, flashing images, these books must have just seemed so remarkable. So I think in a way its beauty may have seduced some of its saviors.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't know for sure, and I know that in recent history it has been protected in Sarajevo because it really represents something to Sarajevans of all religions. It represents the multi-ethnic ideal of the city, and Sarajevans are very proud of the Sarajevo Haggadah and the fact that the city has always found its heroes to protect it. And so right now it's carrying a lot of weight for a little tiny book, and it's kind of this symbol of the city's survival as a multi-ethnic place.
That's fabulous. Before we take our break, I wanted to talk about your experience in watching the restoration of it, because we're kind of on that topic. I've been so drawn to illuminated manuscripts myself, and I started trying to collect a few until I realized how very expensive that is.
I think I have one in my collection.
but they're obviously, as you say, you know, even the poor ones are so evocative and compelling. Can you talk about the experience of being with the woman who was restoring it?
This was one of those strokes of luck that sometimes come to you as a novelist just at the right moment. I was really struggling about how to bind all the different stories of this book together in a narrative that would lead the reader through five centuries and so many different cultures. And at that time, when I was still trying to figure it out, I heard that the UN was funding restoration of the actual book in Sarajevo. And so I talked my way into the room, and the conservator, Andrea Pataki, was kind enough to let me sit in while she worked on the book. And I learned what book conservators do and how incredibly talented they have to be, because they have to be scientists who understand chemicals, the lethal toxins that medieval artists used. They have to know the molecular structures of parchments, but they have to be artists as well. They have to understand the intent of the artist so that they can work sensitively on the art. And they have to be craftspeople of a very high order who have the skills to do the repairs, the technical repairs. And then they have to be detectives, because if you do find something trapped in the binding, like a quill pairing, it can contain a wealth of information about where the book was and who might have worked on it.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she'll be back with you next week. And I'm lucky to be able to spend this full hour with Geraldine Brooks, former correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Bosnia, Somalia, and the Middle East, winner of the 2006 Pulitzer for her novel March, and author most recently of the novel People of the Book. Geraldine, welcome back.
Thanks.
I wanted to talk about the kind of the backwater of subjects. You've talked about your interest in what you refer to as the backwater of subject matters and what lurks in the background just out of focus or out of attention. It feels like that's a skill or a talent and I'm not sure what to hone in on that backwater and see what's lurking behind the obvious story. And, it also seems that if the backwater story, is there, it kind of steers away from some of the normal cliches. How do you go about recognizing that thing, whatever it might be and getting at it?
Well, it varies from project to project, but, when I was working on my previous novel, March, which takes the absent father in Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, and through him explores what happens to an idealist who goes to war believing profoundly in a cause and then is disillusioned by what his own army might be capable of. So I had to deal with the Civil War, which is probably some of the most well-trodden ground. there are thousands and thousands of books published every year on this subject. So to find a backwater, I was interested in what was happening behind the lines more than on the front lines, and that led me to the story of the so-called contraband, and this was before the Emancipation Proclamation. The Union Army didn't know what to do with all the African Americans who suddenly were behind Union lines, and yet they weren't yet free people. Mm. They were still enslaved, and so they called them contraband of war. And there are various schemes about what to do with these people, and some of them were sort of idealistic experiments in free labor and education and preparing people for the freedom that the idealists in the Union Army believed was coming, and others were just brutal, exploitative. We've got an enslaved workforce here, let's use it to make a buck. And a lot of northern speculators actually went south and leased southern cotton plantations where the owners had been driven off, and some of them made a much worse fist of it than the southern owners had, because their lease was only for a year or two. So a southern owner, even though he's conceiving of a human being as chattel, it's chattel that he's got a lifetime investment in, so you don't work people to death. But the model of the northern interventions in the south tended to be more like situations that pertained in the West Indies, where people were just worked and worked until they died because it was so cheap to replace them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was all interesting to me, and I hadn't seen much written about it. So that was where I decided to send my idealistic northern minister into one of those situations.
And and on, you know, as you were talking about earlier with this most recent novel, just having, you know, enough to hold on to, knowing that the factual story is just intriguing enough that gives you a jumping off point into something else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the origins of people's ideas are so interesting to me, and where they come from and how they bubble up.
Yeah, so in People of the Book, the well-trodden ground, of course, was World War II. And I had to think how to approach this subject, which, you know, has had so much written about it and so much light shone into so many corners of it. And so I decided to do it through the vehicle of a young teenage Jewish partisan who was driven out of Sarajevo when the city was occupied by the Nazis and the Jews were deported, and she joined Tito's band of resistors in the mountains. And again, that was something that I think, you know, perhaps less was known about what went on there.
Yeah, this was interesting to me because the novel strings back and forth through time as it follows the past of the book. And for each of the sections, it requires you of the, you know, as the author, a different cadence and a different syntax of language and a different vocabulary as you follow the book around the world and through different time periods. And so each section, in essence, demands its own voice. You know, they're almost mini stories within the major story.
Yeah, I think of it as sort of a collection of novellas tied together by the story in the present.
Yeah. Was it a struggle to find the right voice for each of the time periods?
I think that the hardest thing was, it's easier for me if you're going back in time with people who speak English, because then you can actually read journals of the time and court records and wills and actually see the unusual English vocabulary that people were really using at that time. And so my first novel, Year of Wonders, which was set in a Derbyshire village in 1666, I was able to actually look up Derbyshire dialect words and you know, wide words, colloquial speech and so forth. When I was writing about medieval Spain, obviously I wasn't writing in medieval, I mean, Spanish didn't even exist in the first period that I'm writing about. It was still a sort of proto-Spanish language that was sharing space with Arabic and Ladino and Latin. So obviously, I couldn't do that, and I couldn't convey exactly the sound and the timbre of that, so I had to try and find a sort of comparable medieval English form, and that was kind of difficult. So I think I prefer to take my historical period in English from now on.
Yeah, that's incredible, the research and the getting that right. I fell into every section completely, so...
Oh, wonderful.
It worked. I think if you don't mind, I'll have you read to us, and we can hear what we're talking about here.
Well, I might. First of all, okay. I might read you a little bit from the near present, and my protagonist is an Australian book conservator called Hannah Heath, and this is where she first encounters the Haggadah. As many times as I've worked on rare, beautiful things, that first touch is always a strange and powerful sensation. It's a combination between brushing a live wire and stroking the back of a newborn baby's head. No conservator had handled this manuscript for a century. I had the forms positioned, ready. I hesitated for just a second, a Hebrew book, therefore, spine to the right, and laid it in the cradling foam. Until you opened it, the book was nothing that an untrained eye would look twice at. It was small, for one thing, convenient for use at the Passover dinner table. Its binding was of an ordinary 19th century style, soiled and scuffed. A codex as gorgeously illustrated as this one would originally have had an elaborate binding. You don't make filet mignon and then serve it on a paper plate. The binder might have used gold leaf or silver tooling, maybe inlays of ivory or pearl shell. But this book had probably been rebound many times in its long life. The only one we knew about for sure, because it had been documented, was the last time, in Vienna, in the 1890s. Unfortunately, the book had been terribly mishandled in that instance. The Austrian binder had cropped the parchment heavily and discarded the old binding, something no one, especially not a professional working for a major museum, would ever do anymore. It was impossible to say what information might have been lost at that time. He had bound the parchments in simple cardboard covers with an inappropriate Turkish printed floral paper decoration, now faded and discolored. Only the corners and spine were calfskin, and this was dark brown and flaking away, exposing the edge of the gray board beneath. I ran my middle finger lightly along the cracked corners. These I would consolidate over the coming days. As my finger followed the edges of the board, I noticed something unexpected. The binder had made a pair of channels and a set of small holes in the board edge to accept a pair of clasps. It was unusual for books of parchment to have clasps. It was usual for books of parchment to have clasps to hold the pages flat, yet there were no clasps on this binding. I made a note to myself to investigate this. Moving the forms to support the spine, I opened the cover and leaned close to examine the torn end papers. I would mend these with wheat paste and shreds of matching linen paper. I could see at once that the linen cords the Viennese binder had used were frayed, barely holding. This meant I would have to take the quires apart and restitch them. Then I breathed deeply and turned the page to the parchment of the manuscript itself. This was what mattered. This was what would disclose what four hard years had done to a survivor of five centuries.
Mm. That was Geraldine Brooks reading from her novel, People of the Book, available now and published by Viking. It's amazing. There are later on in the book, in one of the sections, some hard-to-read torture scenes, a few torture scenes.
Well, you can't write about the Spanish Inquisition and avert your gaze from that. So I knew I was going to have to get into that.
Right.
Because the Inquisition, of course, was the precursor to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain.
And it took place in at the end of the, I'm going to terribly mispronounce the name, but at the end of the Convivencia, right?
Yeah, Convivencia refers to a couple of centuries when Christians and Muslims and Jews lived together in Spain, if not always in a, you know, perfect love fest, at least in a spirit of coexistence and an exchange of information and knowledge. And the rise of the fear and hatred of the other that was represented by the Inquisition gradually led to Ferdinand and Isabel's decision to expel all Muslims and Jews from Spanish territory. And it started with the Jews in 1492.
Mm.
And Columbus actually writes about the pathetic scenes at the port when he was preparing for his expedition to the New World.
Yeah, I was going to say that's kind of an ironic year for all of this to be going on when our mainland was discovered, too, and some kind of amazing.
Yeah, well, actually, it wasn't the mainland that he got to. It was
that's
the Dominican Republic.
Right.
It will draw a veil over that, as thousands have.
Right. Wherever he set off to. Yeah, I was just thinking about those scenes and this time period, and you know, I thought it was all interesting, particularly with the acknowledgement that came out, you know, yesterday on our use of waterboarding finally by the U.S. government, and this and other themes of the book, you know, including kind of the apparent destiny of the Haggadah. It seems to be a case of, you know, kind of deja vu all over again.
Well, you know, the weird thing was I wrote the earliest historical chapters of the book first. And so I started at the end, really, and worked forward in time when I was writing the book. So I wrote the Spanish Inquisition chapter called Salt Water before we'd got ourselves entangled in the Iraq War.
Mm.
And I remember thinking as I was researching it and reading, I mean, there's a lot of first-person accounts because the Inquisition kept records, and they recorded every interrogation in excruciating detail.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading about what we now call waterboarding. This terrible, terrible, you know, pseudo-drowning torture. And thinking, God, thank God we've come a long way from that. And then I couldn't believe it when I heard that we were doing that again. It just was so dispiriting to me that we haven't moved morally one inch from the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, yeah, that's amazing. There's something that intrigues me also about your depiction of gender issues and gender roles. Obviously, during your work in the Middle East and the birth of Nine Parts of Desire, this issue was, you know, probably personal and political for you. And without giving too much away about the novel, there are some interesting plays with gender, one obvious example, but to lesser extents, there are others. Hannah's mother, for instance, is, I think, grappling with a few of those. Was that an unintended byproduct for you, or was that your kind of something you were specifically interested in exploring?
It's always been something that I've been interested in exploring. It wasn't like I set out to you know, think I'll make a character to explore this idea. It's just that when I'm writing, those ideas bubble up, and you know, I came of age, you know, with a kind of a resurgence of feminism, particularly in Australia. Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch was such an incredible, I mean, it landed like a bombshell in the Sydney of my teenage years. So everything changed as a result of that book and others. So I guess, you know, having come of age as a kind of militant Aussie feminist, I guess that's, you know, it's not to be unexpected that ideas about women's roles in the past, you know, would be something that, you know, my fictional characters tend to find themselves enmeshed in. But interestingly, people often have said that my female characters seem too modern. And when they say that, I just want to say, well, you go back and read a little bit more deeply into history, because there have always been ardent female voices railing against their lot.
Mm-hmm.
We 20th century feminists were not the first to be so insightful as to realize that we had a bum deal. And certainly the period when I wrote Year of Wonders, 1666, women were really finding their angry voices in a big way during the restoration of Charles II. Mm. They were asserting themselves culturally and legally and just demanding a place at the table. And to think that everybody was silent and cowed and, you know, just getting on with it is a complete misunderstanding, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. you talked earlier, and I wanted to talk again about how people are changed by catastrophe seems to be the DNA of much of your work. And I guess, you know, it's probably the DNA of much of the work of literary fiction. But the essentials of human nature are, you know, are obviously best demonstrated when they're kind of pushed to their extremes. And I'm curious, from your fiction and particularly your nonfictional works, of all the things you've witnessed, do you think that's essentially a good place, that people generally act good in bad situations?
Oh, I don't think you can generalize. I think you see both happen. I mean, just in our catastrophe of recent memory, 9/11, you saw people turn up for work that day who probably had no idea that they had a hero lurking inside their demure office worker exterior or window washer exterior, and then suddenly that inner courage was called on, and they did great things. And then on, you know, the day following, you saw people giving in to their worst impulses, and I'm thinking of the person who murdered the Sikh, thinking that was a Muslim, and just enacting anger at the other in the most base and ill-considered and inhuman way. So I don't, you know, and also, you know, we also saw the hot satisfactions of revenge. We were very quick to seize on that as the only answer when there might have been many better answers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I as we were talking about earlier, the lessons are repeated, but they're so rarely learned. It's amazing. You described this novel at one point as insanely ambitious, and you know it's hard to argue with that. It is insanely ambitious. How did you? You were talking just a moment ago about writing it backwards, and I'm curious how you go about assembling this into something manageable. And it sounds like you knew the points in time where you needed to stop and delve in.
Well, I let the book kind of tell me. I mean, the real Sarajevo Haggadah, I let the known facts determine where I was going to plunge in. So I knew that there would be a story set in 1609 when the Catholic priest saves the book. I knew there had to be some accounting for the artist who did the illuminations, and that would be the earliest chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, obviously the expulsion of the Jews. And then I thought, well, the book was in Vienna in the 1890s, and, you know, in my ignorance, I said, oh, I wonder what was going on in Vienna that year. And hooly-dooly, there was so much going on in Vienna that year, you know, so Klimt and Mahler and Freud and Herzl were all and shaping art and ideology in so many ways, and just such an interesting time. So so I sort of let the book tell me where to enter the historical continuum.
The amazing thing about this was that it felt like, as you said, it felt like novellas, and each section felt so rich. The characters, for me, really jumped off the page and at each turn. So it felt like you had the luxury of time of the novel, but yet you were getting out the salient points of a short story. It was almost, the two greatest things showing off the best parts of their genres all at the same time. It was really amazing.
Well, thank you for that. I've never actually written a short story. Well, not intentionally. So that's very kind of you to say.
it was very rich on every level. Every section, there wasn't one that paled in comparison to any other one. It was amazing. And you had talked about your struggle to get Hannah's voice. Hannah became you made her an Australian.
Yeah, Hannah wasn't originally Hannah. She was a Bosnian woman. But Sarajevans have a very, very, very distinctive voice. It's a layered thing, and there's cadences of Slavic soulfulness, and there are wonderful overlays of Ottoman politeness and flowery expression, and then there's this kind of mordant wit and cynicism that came from shifting under communism for several decades. So it's an interesting and wonderful voice, and I wasn't getting it with my conservator. It just didn't sound authentic to me.
Mm.
So I decided to bin about 50 pages with that character and start all over again with a voice I could hear. And so Hannah is a very familiar voice to me.
Right. We're kind of drawing down on the clock here, but I'm curious. I don't want to turn the discussion political, but it's probably on our minds this morning.
Yeah, well, don't be afraid. I'm a total political junkie.
It's hard not to be thinking about it this morning. And, you know, I'm curious with Nine Parts of Desire, your work in the Middle East and your observations there. If we're ready for a woman in the White House, if other parts, maybe the U.S. is, do you think other parts of the world are?
Oh, other parts of the world have been streets ahead of us. I wrote a piece way back for the Wall Street Journal about how was it that all the Muslim countries had got a woman leader before we had. I don't think that there's any doubt that we're ready for the right woman in the White House. But I also get impatient with people who say a woman is per se better, because we saw with Margaret Thatcher that is not necessarily the case. And I would no sooner vote for any woman than I'd vote for any ex. I look right for the best candidate, and I might as well come right out of the closet here and say that my husband and I spent our wedding anniversary canvassing for Barack Obama in New Hampshire back before that primary, and it was the coldest weekend of my life. If there's a colder place anywhere than suburban New Hampshire, I hope to never visit. But well, I actually think that, you know, having worked in the Middle East and Africa and other places, that if Barack Obama were to become president of this country, it would change the world's image of us overnight, and we would have a whole new opportunity for solving the world's problems with multilateral cooperation. I just think it would confound every stereotype and expectation and misguided view of what our country is.
Mm. Well, I might as well come out of the closet with you and say I absolutely agree. I'm with you 100%. This was a huge pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me and letting me rant.
Thanks so much for taking the time. That was the wonderful Geraldine Brooks, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many things, but most recently, People of the Book, available now and published by Viking. I should mention that Geraldine will be at Borders Books tomorrow on Westwood Boulevard in L.A., tomorrow, February 7th at 7 p.m., doing a talk and PowerPoint presentation. You can check out her website at geraldinebrooks.com for more details on that. I took a quote from the beginning of Geraldine's novel that I thought was sort of apropos of our discussion and our show generally, and it is this by Heinrich Heine. "There, where one burns books, one in the end burns men." Barbara will be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 with T. Jefferson Parker. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day.